Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Dr. Ron Hassner, an associate professor of political science at the University of California at Berkeley, and a returning guest to our show, who also has the distinct honor of being featured as one of the few encore presentations, meaning that his earlier interview was so excellent that it served as a rerun when our staff was on vacation. Professor Hassner specializes in the study of religion and international conflict and is author of the highly acclaimed book, War on Sacred Grounds, which I've used in some of my undergraduate classes. And he has also put together an edited volume entitled Religion in the Military Worldwide. He is in the process of finishing up another book tentatively entitled Religion on the Battlefield, which is likely due out next spring, as well as having a host of articles in some of our discipline's top journals, such as Security Studies, International Security, and Politics and Religion. He is an award-winning instructor at Cal, co-directs Berkeley's Religion and Politics program, and founded the Religion and International Relations section of the International Studies Association, which he also serves as the benevolent insect overlord of. All of this stuff will be linked on our website, so please head on over there and check it out. Ron, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. Thanks for having me.
The issue of religion and conflict has really been a hot-button issue lately, and your first book, War on Sacred Grounds, did a fantastic job of discussing why religion makes conflict so intractable so often. Now, we featured that book on our podcast a few years ago, but if you could, give us a quick summary of that work to refresh any new listeners that we have.
I'm happy to. As you know, every academic is happy to talk endlessly about the work, particularly when they're an insect overlord.
Yes.
So I started writing this book in 97 before religion was really a topic of wide scholarly interest among IR scholars. And what I tried to show struck people at the time as, I think, relatively counterintuitive, relatively surprising. And that was that certain places would be fought over differently if they had religious characteristics. So we know that territorial disputes are one of the primary causes of disagreements between states, and people have studied territorial disputes to no end. And I looked at a particular kind of territorial disputes, disputes over territories considered holy or sacred, and tried to offer an argument from the sociology of religion about why these conflicts are unique. And the argument I made goes something like this. If you're trying to resolve a territorial dispute, you don't have that many options. Option number one is to introduce some flexibility about boundaries. Sort of enlarge the pie and suggest that this piece of land we're arguing about is actually a little bigger, or it's located somewhere else, and you sort of shift the boundaries around, and so everybody can have their own little piece of territory and walk away happy. Option number two is that you cut the piece of territory in half, give each side, or half, or, you know, one-third, two-third, you somehow slice it apart. And option number three is that one side gets to keep it and the other side gets money or some other good in return. And, of course, you can combine these options. And I tried to show that none of these options are possible in the case of sacred space. For religious reasons, holy places have very clearly defined boundaries. There's no wiggle room about where the great mosque in Mecca starts and ends. It's inscribed in religious law and religious practice. There's also no way of dividing sacred places. Their different parts hang together. So even though a big mosque or a big Hindu temple or a big Catholic cathedral have lots of different parts, if you take away one of those parts, the building can no longer function the way it's supposed to. So I describe this as indivisibility. You cannot take those buildings and parcel them out, just like babies are indivisible, right? They're no good to their parents if you take apart and remove it.
Yeah, the old Solomon's judgment.
That's right, the old Solomon's Judgment. And in fact, Solomon's Judgment here is very telling. If you remember the story, Solomon's Judgment is a ruse to ferret out which of the mothers is a fake mother. And it's only a fake mother who would ever agree to dividing her baby in half, right? Either a fake mother or an insane person.
Mm-hmm.
And so similarly, anybody who agrees to divide a sacred space in half obviously does not understand that religion, is not an adherent of that religious group. And option number three, as I said, was to offer people money or some other kind of good in exchange, and no religious communities can accept that in return for its sacred space. And so sacred spaces have become very, very difficult to handle when conflict breaks out. It doesn't even have to be conflict between religions. Sometimes, as in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, it's conflict within Christianity. Divisions don't work. Parties remain constantly unhappy. These places, as the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, become flashpoints of violence. There are many cases in India as well. And I then suggest ways to address that.
This is an amazing book. I really have to compliment you on it. I'm glad you summarized
it
again, because it's a book that when I read it, I went, oh, yeah, I never thought of that. But once I think about it, it makes perfect sense. And that's the academic book that you always want to be writing, that nobody knows it, but once they hear it, they say, obviously, this is the case. And so it is a really cool book, and a very timely one today, too. When you talk about ISIS blowing up sacred ground or the old Assyrian temples and things like that, it puts a lot of this into the context. You mentioned you suggested a few ways of getting around these rather intractable conflicts. Briefly summarize some of those.
Right. So, again, because I was talking to an audience, and by the time the book came out, 9/11 had just happened, people were still trying to wrap their brains around how we should think about religion and conflict. And I made, and I think you put it very nicely and very kindly, I made a very simple point. Look, if you have a problem related to geography and war, you consult a geographer. And if you have a problem related to economics and war, you consult an economist. And if you have a problem related to religion and war, you cannot just treat it as a political problem. You have to talk to religious experts. Some of those are scholars, but the best religious experts are religious leaders. We tend to be suspicious of religious leaders, and I think justly so. Religious leaders can make things a lot worse. But religious leaders have several capabilities that really should offer them a seat at the negotiation table. The first is they know stuff. They know about exactly where the boundaries are. They know exactly what the value of a sacred place is. They know about the parts that can and can't be detached from a sacred site. So, firstly, you just need to get your hands on some information. And I show in the book that when decision makers try to address these conflicts without that information, they make really stupid mistakes. Right? It's just plain religious stupidity. That they'll try to attack a sacred site and induce forceful change, but they'll do it at the most holy day in the year. They'll try not to harm the site, but instead they'll aim their weapons at what then turns out to be the most valuable part, because they just don't understand the makeup of the sacred site. So first of all, you need to talk to rabbis and imams and priests, because they have information that you need. Second, if you exclude them from the negotiation process, they can act as veto players. And third, and here I'm really pushing my argument, I'm out on a limb here. Under certain circumstances, religious leaders can persuade their followers to rethink the parameters of a sacred space. So the simple example is, look, every time we build a highway, there's a sacred site in its path, an old cemetery, a church, or every time a religious building has to be taken down because it's decrepit or because it's been damaged in an earthquake or in war, sacred leaders come in and they have ways of removing the sanctity of that place. This requires ritual. And then projecting that sanctity onto a new place. So cemeteries get relocated all the time. It's really not a big deal. Religious leaders know how to do this. Now, it's not so easy for a religious leader to come in and say, I hereby declare the Temple Mount in Jerusalem to be of no value, or I hereby relocate it to Tel Aviv. That can't be done. But they can, at the margins, persuade followers that the value is higher or lower, that it's worth dying or killing for, or that it's not worth dying or killing for. In the case of Jerusalem, I trace in the book an example of rabbis who say, yes, this place is tremendously important, but we prohibit you from going there and clashing with Muslims on the Temple Mount. Or in another case I document in 1979 in Mecca, the Saudi clerics rule that the Grand Mosque in Mecca is tremendously important, but they permit the shedding of blood there under certain circumstances. So that gives you flexibility in negotiations that you don't have if you don't consult religious leaders.
Yeah, very timely book. And again, I want to point everybody back to that one to make sure that they get a chance to read it, because it is a really well-written book. I have to admit, though, when reading it, I kept thinking about the Stanford-Cal game. Is that sacred ground?
The Stanford-Cal game is not sacred ground, but the axe.
Mm.
The axe is indivisible. So you'll know this because I know you're a big sports fan.
Mm-hmm.
That the axe became over the years a trophy of the Cal Stanford game. It used to be sort of the Stanford fetish. Emil Durkheim would love this. It was sort of the symbol of Stanford unity because Stanford's a farm and the axe was an axe that was used on the farm until the Berkeley football rally stole the axe, and it was then stolen back by Stanford, and it went back and forth from campus to campus. And these theft incidents were quite violent.
Hmm.
They involved, at one point, the use of tear gas grenades and a highway chase through the Bay Area. And at that point, the presidents of the University of California and Stanford decided that the axe would go to whoever won the game. So the axe itself is indivisible.
Yeah.
Two sides can't have it at the same time. So this arrangement was worked on. It's a very good arrangement that the sites would take turns.
Mm. It
is relevant.
Yeah, no, it's neat how many of our academic theories can actually explain things in our daily lives, which are kind of fun. And I know that you have somewhat of a stake in game. I don't know if you're a big college football fan, but you went to Stanford and you're now at Cal. So are you indivisible, or do you just win both times?
It's odd. I use this when I teach my students about how dangerous statistics are. So in the 6 years I spent at Stanford as a graduate student, Stanford won each and every big game.
Mm-hmm.
Until the year 2002, when Berkeley interviewed me for the job that I currently hold. That was the first year in decades that Berkeley won the big game. And as soon as I moved over to the Berkeley campus, Berkeley did not lose a single game against Stanford. Until the year 2007, when I was at Stanford for a sabbatical. So when I came up for tenure, I wrote a very terse letter to the leadership of the Berkeley campus and said, guys, there's a lot at stake here. Whatever campus I'm on has consistently won the great game. You need to think seriously and carefully about your next move.
Yeah, they gotta retain you.
Yeah,
there could be
they gotta retain
war.
Me, and then they retained me, and then the statistical pattern fell apart.
Yeah,
so much for statistics.
Yeah, well, tenure ruins everything, I guess.
That's exactly right.
Anyways, let's move on. And the new focus of your research moves from actual battles between two armies and looks inside military organizations themselves in order to understand the role that the religion plays in the military. Really fascinating. Again, these are things that we don't necessarily look at very much. So how'd you come about on this topic? Was it a natural outgrowth of some of your previous work or what?
It sort of was. So thinking about it in retrospect, the first book, I think, was a natural response to the interest in religious ideas in the years leading up to 9/11 and the years after 9/11. I now feel that natural response was slightly misguided. And if you want to, we can talk about this in detail or not, but I think because an American audience was watching 9/11, because they were watching an extremist Islamist movement, which they felt was motivated by religious ideas, academia became really, really obsessed with thinking about religion in particular ways, and here are those particular ways. They became obsessed with thinking about religion as an idea. They became obsessed with thinking about radical, extreme religious ideas, and they became concerned exclusively with radical non-state actors holding those ideas. So it was all about, you know, crazy suicide bombers, you know, blowing themselves up.
Yeah.
You know, I understand where that comes from. I think some of it also has to do with our sort of Protestant secular inclinations of thinking of religion as a personal relationship that a human has with God that motivates their actions. That's not how most people on earth actually think about religion. The religion that most people on earth practice, and that's the key word, is not an idea, it's a practice. It's something you don't just think about, it's also something you do. And most people on earth do not hold radical religious ideas. They hold very straightforward day-to-day religious ideas and practices. And that's not exclusive to terrorists and insurgents. That's true for you and me, and it's true for U.S. soldiers today, and it's true for British soldiers in World War I. And so my question was, okay, we've studied the religious ideas of crazy people. Should we maybe also look at how religion shapes the day-to-day behavior of soldiers in modern professional armies? And so I wanted to write a book about how religion shapes modern war, and discovered very quickly that there was simply no empirical evidence out there. Nobody had ever gathered the information that I needed to start writing that book. We knew nothing about how American soldiers pray. We know nothing about the functions that Canadian or Indian chaplains perform on the battlefield. We simply haven't collected the information that would allow us to look at rituals, at hierarchies. Does, you know, questions like, does promotion in the U.S. military, is it influenced by religion? We'd like to think it isn't, but maybe it is. You know, it'd be interesting to know.
Yeah, I got to break in here and mention to any students who are listening, oftentimes they get very discouraged when they stumble upon a topic that is interesting and then look for any literature on it and can't find it. And they go, oh, nobody's written on this. And I said, yippee, that means you can now.
That's right.
The field's wide open. Yeah.
It sounds like great news, but there was really just nothing for me to base an argument on. And so, you know, I did the logical first step. I put together a group of the smartest people I could find and said, please help me gather the information into a volume. And so that became Religion in the Military Worldwide. It's a collection of experts around the world, not doing a lot of theorizing about why certain religious practices prevail here and there, but just sharing all the information they have about what's going on in, you know, what I would consider to be some of the most interesting militaries around the world. And my goal, in part, because I became less and less interested in, you know, Islamist extremism, my goal in part was to write about the cases that people would least expect to find in a book like this. So, you know, of course, there's a chapter about Pakistan. You know, that too is an interesting case because, sure, it's Islam, but it's not extremist Islam. Pakistani military officers and Pakistani soldiers are not violent fanatics. They're just soldiers. So here the twist on the question is, okay, let's study how Islam affects violence, but let's study how Islam affects violence in a setting where it hasn't been studied, which is a standard professional military force. But then I also included cases that you really wouldn't have expected to find in a book on religion and violence, like the Canadian military, like the Japanese military.
Yeah, I have to say, I didn't even know Canada had a military until I read your book.
It's not much of a military, but you know they have to defend the maple syrup as best they can.
Yeah. Now we got to apologize to our Canadian listeners. We actually have somebody up in Moose Jaw who listens to us on a regular basis. So you can, Canada, we do know you have an army, and it's a fine
and
one.
And you know, surprisingly enough, as I went to look for scholars to contribute to the book, this too turned out to be very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
The only scholars I could find who had made a career out of studying religion in a particular military were Joanne Benham-Renick, who studied religion in the Canadian Armed Forces and did produce very, very interesting work, and a professor from Israel called Stuart Cohen, who had dedicated his life to studying religion in the Israeli military. So the others, I really had to look long and hard to find, you know, who was going to write the chapter on Japan for me.
Yeah, nobody thinks of the Japanese military as being a major force to begin with, but then nobody even thinks about Japan as having much of a spiritual presence on the religious landscape.
That's right. Yeah. But nonetheless, the chapter in Japan turned out to me to be so interesting that I made it the first chapter in the book. Because I really wanted to send a strong message. This is not a book about the kind of violent religion that you're used to reading. This is a book about the day-to-day religious practices of soldiers around the world, because no soldier in his right mind would ever participate in war without some religious backing, or at least some variation on a religious backing. Mm-hmm. And Japan turns out to be a fascinating example. So for Japan, it was really hard to find contributing authors. What I ended up doing was convincing a scholar who was an expert in the Japanese military to combine forces with a Japanese scholar who was an expert on religion in Japan, and they wrote the chapter together, and it's a pretty hair-raising story.
Yeah. Well, we're going to come up to that in a minute, so that's a little bit of a teaser, but not only do you call experts from academia around the globe, but you also found a few experts who have actually lived it, and your book starts out with this rather interesting story about this Israeli soldier, and I think he was peeling potatoes or washing dishes or something in the IDF. Where'd you find that story?
So it's a story about an Israeli soldier who was an intelligence analyst. Huh. In charge of a, you know, pretty large unit of soldiers, and this was actually at a time of war, who was called away from his intelligence duties in order to religiously prepare the army camp's kitchen for Passover. Now, you know, I don't know how well aware the listeners are of the very, very arduous process that a Orthodox kitchen has to undergo in order to be kosher for Passover. But the IDF, from its founding, has assured all of its soldiers that the strictest standards of religious observation will be held in all army camps. This even though Israel is very, very predominantly a secular country, much more secular than the United States, in fact. So even though, you know, less than 10%, I'd say, of the soldiers serving in the Israeli army are truly Orthodox, all kitchens in every army camp are held to the highest standards of kosher. And so this analyst spent 2 days boiling dishes under the supervision of two rabbinical supervisors. And I know the story because it was me.
Oh my gosh! It was you. Yeah, I know. That's actually it was a really fun story to open up the book with, because I'm reading about this, and it all of a sudden turned out to be Professor Hassner at Cal. I mean, here you are as an intelligence analyst washing dishes in the Army.
That's right. It wasn't just washing dishes. I had to boil them. So, yeah. So two very, very, very large pots of boiling water were placed in the middle of the parking lot behind the kitchen. Anybody who lives in a Jewish Orthodox neighborhood, you know, whether it's Golders Green in London or Crown Heights in Brooklyn, will have seen these, because they usually neighborhoods will put them up together. And every plate, fork, knife, spoon, everything in that kitchen had to be dunked for a particular period of time in a particular manner into the boiling water in order to, the term is kosher it, in order to make it kosher for Passover, and it was fascinating. It was something I was not used to. I certainly do not come from an Orthodox Jewish household. I was learning it on the job, and it was enough of a priority for the military for two reasons. First, to make it possible for observant soldiers to continue eating, and second, because, you know, it is the national army of the Jewish homeland, and so it's entirely appropriate that it follow important Jewish practices. But this extends to all aspects of army life, not just food. It extends to how the genders are separated. It extends to living arrangements. It extends to uniforms and regulations about beards. It extends to how religious holidays are observed, where ceremonies are held. So Jerusalem is of course, a particularly important place for military induction ceremonies. It extends to the names of units and the names of ranks and the names of military operations and the names of weapons. Religion affects all of these. Whether that's important or not, I don't know, but it sure is really interesting.
It is, and it's a really neat story that you begin the book with, because this is one of those things that seems rather mundane. I mean, I'm sure, you know, a long time ago you were out there washing dishes in the parking lot or dunking them into boiling water and never realizing, hey, someday I'm going to write a book about this.
That's right.
Did you get pictures?
You mean pictures for the book or pictures at the time?
No, pictures of that would have been great for the cover of the book.
No, pictures of that. It was an Army intelligence camp, so no pictures at all.
Oh, okay. So you got to...
That was where the seeds for the book were planted. I was, for the first time, in the company of religiously observant soldiers, and I saw how that shaped their military practice. So, you know, one of the great things about living in a country like the U.S. or Israel and then serving in its armed forces is it's a real melting pot. People from different sectors of society, different socioeconomic background, different religious background, get together and learn about one another's practices.
Mm-hmm.
I really, you know, it was my first lesson in organized religion. It was very interesting. I thought you'd be excited about the story, true or not, from, I think, the second Indo-Pakistani war, in which the Pakistani shelling hurts some cows who are meandering over the battlefield, and the Indian soldiers are running into the battlefield to bandage up the cows.
Yeah.
I mean, here's another example where, if the story's true, and it may not be, religion shapes how people think about their behavior on the battlefield. And it's not about ideas,
mm-hmm.
or at least it's not just about ideas. It's not about, you know, is there one God, or is do I believe in the Trinity? Do I believe in the physical resurrection of Christ? What is my notion of jihad? It's none of this. It's about, what can I eat? What can I wear? What sort of orders do I follow? Which weapons do I consider appropriate and inappropriate? What times of year are good for me to fight in and not good for me to fight in? Which places may I or may I not enter during military operations? How do I treat civilians? These aren't ideas. These are practices.
Mm-hmm. And the story of the Hindu soldier who ran out on the battlefield to battle dress a cow that had been injured, it gives you there's an idea behind that, but you can just imagine, if the story is true, just the immediate reaction. You don't really think about it and do a big theological debate about whether you should do this. This is a practice that you've done for years and years that you know, you consider this animal to be holy. And you just rush out there. And that is going to affect battlefield practice, right? Because, you know, your general's saying, wait a minute, where's that guy going? We need him back here. But he's trying to drag a cow back to the foxhole. And you know, and that's what really makes the story fascinating. I did find that story to be really interesting. But seriously, the picture in my mind of Professor Hassner washing dishes, I mean, I think we need to reenact that photo and then use that as the cover for your next book.
Yeah, no, it's really easy. You know, it's happening. It happens every spring in, you know, hundreds of army camps around Israel. And there are parallels to it in all the armed forces around the world.
So your book is divided into a couple thematic issues, and you sifted these out as you're talking with the people that you brought together for this volume. And the issues that come up are religious demographics. And we already get a flavor for that. So in Israel, you would think, well, everybody's Jews. That's pretty easy. But, you know, it's only 10% are really observant. And, you know,
that's right. And by the way, it's not true that everybody's Jewish. Israel has both Bedouin and Druze units. So there are both Shia Muslims and Sunni Muslims in the Israeli military. In fact, they're often put in quite dangerous spots and participate actively in combat. But yes, it is. It's predominantly a Jewish military that is now dealing with. Well, this gets complicated, but it's now dealing with a large sector of Israeli society that immigrated from Russia that may or may not be Jewish. So this raises, for the first time, the question of how do you deal with Christians or Christians pretending to be Jews. In the Israeli army, and it, for example, raises issues of burial in military cemeteries, most of which are Jewish cemeteries.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. And let's go ahead and start with that theme of the book. There's a few others in there about that deal with religious
practice. Demographics, again, I wanted them to produce empirically rich information. I wanted some numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to know whether the distribution of religions in the U.S. military reflects the distribution of religions in American society. You'd think that would be an easy question to answer. It turns out to be a very hard question to answer.
Hmm.
The U.S. military is very, very reluctant to share information about the religiosity of its soldiers. Some of that is just considered private. Some of that is considered, just unhealthy data to gather.
Mm-hmm.
Because if there is indeed a skewed demographic, that may be problematic. The U.S. military has come under attack in recent years for its evangelical tendencies, so particularly in the Air Force. So it would be sort of bad if you showed, that the number of evangelicals in the Army is growing and growing and growing. Even though the military collects this information for itself, it is not very happy to share it with others. And it's not happy to give scholars access to soldiers to ask them questions about religion. And the same turns out to be true for some others. So part of what scholars do in their despair is they look for visual clues. You'll have scholars of the Israeli military who are trying to assess religious numbers, and they're not so much interested in percentage of Jews versus non-Jews. They're more interested in what kinds of Jews, whether they're Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox. Ultra-Orthodox tend not to serve, but do they tend to be the kind of observant Jews who are affiliated with the settler movement, or do they tend to be the kind of observant Jews who are not? And they do this by looking at skull caps, yarmulkes. So they'll go to an officer graduation ceremony and they'll sit in the back and they'll count how many soldiers are wearing skull caps on their head and what color and fabric they're made of, which tells you a lot about the religious practices of the person. Or in the Pakistani military, they'll count beards. Which is a sad proxy, but often that's the best you can do to get your hands on numbers.
Yeah. So what are some of the findings here? Because the issue of demographics, I mean, just thinking about it theoretically and also practically, is if you have everybody the same, if you have a homogenous community and they're all equally practicing, then it's probably not going to be too difficult to manage the situation. But as soon as you start to introduce some heterogeneity, both in terms of denominations and level of practice, things are going to get a little bit more complicated. So what did the scholars that you asked to write these chapters on find in general? Are there any general patterns, or do we see...
There are no general patterns. It varies from country to country, and you'd expect that, not just because the countries vary in their uniformity or not mm-hmm. in terms of religion, but also because the militaries vary in their relationship to society. So some of these militaries, as in Israel, we have a case of general conscription. Everybody in the country, with few exceptions, has to serve in the military. And so the military represents society in a pretty faithful way. But then you have a professional army like the U.S. military, where people volunteer to serve, and you don't get a lot of very wealthy Americans serving in the military. You don't get a lot of Americans from the northern half of the United States serving in the military, proportionally speaking. So you'd expect that to somehow distort the demographics. So many of the scholars who contributed to the volume were not able to find numbers at all.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them relied on proxies. So, for example, counting how many chaplains of different denominations there are.
Mm-hmm.
That'll give you a hint. Others did, beard and skull cap counting. One of them just did a quick poll among the soldiers she was working with. She had about 200, 300 soldiers, and regularly, once a year, would sort of ask them to fill out a little form and tell her what their backgrounds were, and that gave her a general hunch.
Mm-hmm.
But the pattern changes from military to military and changes from year to year. The other demographic kinds of questions I was interested in had to do with the makeup of particular units. So even if the military as a whole either represents or distorts religion in society, What about a particular unit? So what about the Air Force? Or what about this particular part of the Air Force? Here, the numbers are even harder to get at, and not a single scholar was willing to go out on a limb and answer my last demographic question, which was, does membership in a particular religious group affect promotion? Because you can imagine that the answer to that would be pretty explosive. I think many of them shared my hunch that even though most militaries do not put the members of particular religious groups in particular units, the Indian military is an exception to this. There's a lot of religious engineering going on, and a lot of thought put into which soldiers should go into which units and how you create the right mix of ethnicities and religions and who you put in command of that unit. But most militaries don't do this. They allow soldiers to essentially self-select into units. But this self-selection is also an interesting process. If you think about particularly very small, very cohesive military units that have a very proud military tradition, if those units tend to be relatively religiously uniform, you'd expect soldiers to know this and to join them or not join them based on their own religious background. And you'd also expect there to be a socialization effect. So if you think of a crack unit of the Navy SEALs, right? A tiny little platoon of Navy SEALs, which for some reason that I can't even come up with, right? They're all Mormon. Let's just make that example up. So here you've got this very, very tight group of soldiers who happen to be Mormon. They're fighting together. They're training together. They're under extreme duress. The risks they take are tremendous. The fatalities are high. And now you join this unit, and you're not a Mormon. Maybe you're even an atheist. You could imagine that over time, you become acculturated to that unit. You take on their practice. Maybe you don't convert to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but it would be very strange if you did not participate in their rituals, if you did not mourn with them at their funerals in the way in which they mourn, if you did not pray with them together 3 minutes before you go out on a mission, if you stood sort of aloof and said, you know, I'm sorry, I'm Jewish, I really can't, you're going to have to pray without me. So I would expect there to be significant socialization pressures, but, you know, that information is very hard to collect.
Yeah, interesting question, too, because you think about the nature of the task that they're meant to perform. You know, part of it's the boot camp, and that's a socialization experience in and of itself that's very stressful. And then if any of them ever head to the battlefield, it's extremely stressful, very existential, right? It's life and death there every minute that you're out in the field on some kind of campaign. And I mean, the issue of norm socialization, of cohesion of those norms is a really interesting place to be studying this.
Right. And so here's a story that didn't make it into the book. I heard it from a veteran, and I didn't put it in the book because I didn't have patience for the whole human subjects process, which the soldier would have to go through in order to clear the story for the book. But the story he tells me is he himself was a Mormon, joined a unit in Afghanistan. That had a very, very dangerous mission. They would have to go out on these lengthy patrols in armored vehicles. It turns out that before he joined the unit had had a so-called lucky Jew. The lucky Jew's job was to sit with the commander in the middle of the three vehicles, in the second vehicle, and bring luck. And before every patrol, the lucky Jew would utter a blessing over the vehicles. Now, there is no such blessing in Judaism, but he just made something up. And that Jew had left the unit, so when the unit discovered that there was now a Mormon there, and he was the only Mormon in the unit, they immediately nominated him to be the lucky Mormon. But he was not a practicing member of the church.
Yeah.
He knew nothing. And even if he had, he would have probably told them, "Look, there's nothing in the church that qualifies me to bring luck to a commander on patrol." But the unit just didn't care. And so he says he stood in front of these vehicles, You know, they're standing inside the compound. The gate's about to open. He stood in front of the vehicles, waved his arms in big circles, uttered some quotes that he barely remembered from the few times he'd been in church, and brought his unit a great deal of comfort. It was very, very important to them that he do this, and it became one of his jobs. So, you know, it's a pretty harmless story, but it sort of suggests that under these very, very pressurized conditions, religion plays a very important role for soldiers.
That brings up one of the other themes that you talk about in your book, which is about the issue of belief and practice.
Yeah.
And we know that different religions have different practices, and that some of these can actually be a little bit incongruent with the rigid discipline of a military. I mean, you could think of very extreme examples. If you have a situation of mandatory conscription and you have Mennonites or Quakers who are pacifist, well,
right.
What do you do with them? You can't hand them a rifle and send them up to the front lines. You could tell them to shoot, but then you're always worried, well, maybe they won't, and that could be an issue. So you got to figure out what to do with them. But, you know, there's other even more mundane things that come up. And one of the issues that we talked about on a recent podcast here on Six was that the hair that they have and the turbans that they wear make it really difficult to put a helmet on. And, you know, so do you say, well, you don't have to wear a helmet, but we need to wear a helmet. So all these things are really kind of interesting, from, you know, big philosophical issues of pacifism down to, you know, what kind of clothes I'm going to wear and does that fit the military uniform. What did all your scholars that contributed to this book find out there?
Yeah, so here again, as you said, that they found the entire range. So as you know, in the U.S. case, Sikh soldiers have fought for the rights to wear, under certain conditions, wear their turbans and not have to wear helmets. Beards are often a big issue, so not just the long hair, but also the beards, which raises issues with gas masks, for example. Sacred time is often an issue, right? How do you conduct military operations or military exercises at times of fasting, whether it's Ramadan or Yom Kippur? How do you maintain a state of military alertness when, you know, it's a holy day on which activity is suspended? Or, on the contrary, a holy day on which, say, consuming alcohol is commanded? Do you allow soldiers to drink? Do you not allow them to drink? Sometimes the clash is not so much with the functioning of the military. Sometimes the clash is a clash with state law. So much of the discussion in the American case studies is about the tensions between what soldiers want and what soldiers are doing and what chaplains are doing, and the requirements of the First Amendment and the notion of separation of church and state in the United States. That's so heated a topic that, as you will have noticed, there's one country in the book that has two chapters dedicated to it, and that's the United States, with two authors who reach very, very different conclusions. But here the Japanese case is perhaps the most interesting. The Japanese practice a far more severe version of separation of church of state, of church and state, to the extent that the Japanese state will not sponsor religion in the military. None at all. There's no provision for chaplains. There's no provision for prayer space. There's no provision for sacred scripture or any of the things that are very commonplace in our armed forces. But at the same time, no Japanese soldier or sailor in their right mind would ever enter an army vehicle, whether it's a helicopter or a ship or a truck, that has not undergone Shinto purification rituals.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, because then the vessel may be haunted by evil spirits. Particularly if there's been a lot of accidents and fatalities, that's a very clear hint that there's something wrong with the vehicle. But so how do you square this? How do you, on the one hand, worry tremendously about the purification of military installations and military vehicles, and on the other hand, the government refuses and, in fact, prohibits the use of priests in army camps? And the answer is, soldiers in the Japanese military cheat. They pass around the hat, they surreptitiously collect funds, they sneak over to the nearby Shinto temple, and they smuggle a priest into the army camp against constitutional regulations and rules. And in fact, the chapter on Japan shows a pretty outrageous photo that's going to cause a lot of people a lot of trouble in Japan. It shows there's a photo there of Japanese officers marching in uniform into a Shinto temple to receive a blessing, which is very, very strictly prohibited, but is completely unavoidable from a religious practice point of view.
So is this one of these things where they just turn a blind eye and say, you know, this is prohibited, but okay, it's not really prohibited.
Or it may be prohibited, but the law doesn't make any sense, and we understand that you're not going to get on an aircraft carrier unless that aircraft carrier, A, has undergone a purification ceremony, B, has had a small shrine installed in it. This shrine is a copy of a physical shrine that is associated with the relevant army camp. So if there's a naval vessel stationed at a particular port, there will be a Shinto shrine nearby, and that's the Shinto shrine of that naval port. And a copy of that shrine will be placed inside the vessel so that the good spirits, the positive spirits, from the shrine can reside in the naval vessel. So this isn't just an altar at which you pray. This is a physical residence for the gods of the shrine who are going to move over to your ship or your aircraft carrier or your airplane, and they will live there. And boy, is that against Japanese law. And yet it's practiced, and you can see the photos in the book.
Yeah. And then, again, we'll link to the book so that people can check it out either in the library, or I would recommend that you buy it because it is a good book to have on your shelf. It's a one-of-a-kind thing until your next book comes out. But that surprised me with Japan because, again, you know, if you ask me the religion of Japan, I go, yeah, you know, there's Shintoism way back in the past. And, you know, there's some Christian movements here and there, but they're pretty minor. It's a very secular society.
Yep.
But it is so infused in the military. Is there some kind of self-selection bias in the demographics?
I think there is.
Okay. I mean, that's absolutely fascinating. And again, difficult information to get, but definitely worthy of more exploring. Since we do have a number of listeners here in the United States, tell us a little bit about the two U.S. chapters. And it is a neat part of the book at the very end, dealing with these constitutional issues, because you have two scholars that really come to different conclusions. So give us a flavor for that.
That's right. That's right. And I had to bring two scholars in because it became very, very clear to me early on that the issue was very, very contentious. And in fact, the only existing sources I could find on religion in the U.S. military were polemical.
Mm-hmm.
They were either for or against. There was very little cool-headed scholarly analysis. The first United States case study is by Martin Cook. Both of the authors are scholars who work with and in the U.S. military. And Martin Cook rings all the alarm bells. He's very, very concerned about the proliferation of religious language in military speeches, the use of military symbols, military music, the presence of religious leaders at obligatory military ceremonies. He has evidence of proselytizing in U.S. Army camps, particularly in the Air Force. And he claims that this also leads to cases of excess on the battlefield, where soldiers will purposefully provoke against Islam or wear items on their bodies, on their uniforms, that are going to cause outrage and are really going to harm our efforts at a Hearts and Minds campaign. The most egregious of these, which I learned about a little more recently, is a bad that became very, very popular in Afghanistan called Pork Eating Crusader. Mm-hmm. And it's a badge. It's about the size of it's a pretty big badge, actually. Maybe the interior of the palm of your hand. And it shows, it says on top, Pork Eating Crusader, and it shows exactly that. It shows a guy in a medieval knight's uniform holding up a ham hock, and underneath it says Pork Eating Crusader in Arabic, just to make sure that everybody who sees it understands what this is about. Now, this is not a religious emblem, but you can imagine that soldiers who think about combat as being a religious conflict and who wear this kind of thing, or engage in Quran burning, or engage in proselytizing of some sort, that these would make things a lot worse. So that's Martin Cook's point of view. Pauletta Otis wrote the follow-on chapter, and she her voice is the soothing voice. Her claim is that, yes, of course, excesses happen. All sorts of excesses happen in all militaries at all times. What's important is that there are procedures in place to check those excesses, and that people who stray from the letter of the law in the military are punished. So that army commanders who allow the display of religious symbols at inappropriate moments are fired. Chaplains who use inappropriate language or refuse to provide religious services to all denominations as they're required to lose their jobs or don't get promoted or get moved somewhere else. And that these that there are very few extreme cases that the public is extremely attentive to, and that that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
We know about these cases. We're acting to control them. Overall, she says, there's nothing religiously unique or extreme about the U.S. military, and she provides a little bit of demographic information to show that, you know, religion in the U.S. military is not much different from religion in American society, and is kept well under check by constitutional requirements.
Yeah, interesting perspective. We recently interviewed a military chaplain, and so we will also link to that to get his perspective on this, and so listeners can check that out. The other third theme, the other major theme of the three main themes in the book, deal with the operation of militaries. And you know, one would hope that nations don't go to war, because wars generally suck, and I think most military officers and soldiers know that war sucks and they really don't want to be there, but you do have to go into war sometimes. So when it comes to that very existential situation of fighting on the battlefield, this life and death conflict, how does all this issue about religious demographic rights and practice and belief really play out in some of the cases that you looked at in this volume?
Right. So that is primarily the topic of my next book, the one that's coming out in the spring, Religion on the Battlefield, in which I show that it really has played itself out in the cases in which you'd least expect it to matter, which is U.S. and military, U.S. and British military operations in the 20th century. So in that book, I show that in World War I, World War II, Vietnam, Korea, the religion of U.S. soldiers and U.S. commanders and the religious requirements of their opponents and the third parties observing have affected our military operations, sometimes more important ways, sometimes in less important ways. This volume, this book that we're talking about today, Religion in the Military Worldwide, takes a first stab at that with two pretty brief case studies. The one case study is Iran. This is a kind of country that you would expect to find in a book on religion in the military. I chose to include an Iranian case study because I knew that the characteristics of the Iranian military during the Iran-Iraq War really affected the fighting.
How so?
In all sorts of ways. So whether it's the structure under which the military operated. So back then and to this day, every unit in the Iranian military is commanded both by a professional military officer and by a sort of religious officer, what in the Soviet Union would have called a commissar. And so there are these sort of two parallel hierarchies, two parallel command structures that ensure that actions are not just in accord with military logic, but also in accord with the ideology of the regime. And infractions are then reported up. So structures is one thing. And there are, in fact, for many units, there are parallel volunteer units that are fighting based on mainly religious motivation. So that's number one. Number two, you have soldiers participating in religious rituals on the battlefield. And these are unique Shia rituals. They invoke the notions of martyrdom. There are stories about Iranian soldiers on the battlefield being given plastic keys to wear around their necks. These were symbolic of the keys of paradise. So the knowledge that if they were killed, which was very, very likely in the Iran-Iraq War, is the bloodiest war the Middle East has ever seen and will ever see for many years to come, that they were dying as martyrs and would go to heaven. They would reenact Ashura rituals, which are the primary Shia martyrdom rituals, to prepare people and explain to them why their life was worth giving to the state. They would name units, they would name battlefields after components of Shia thought. There are stories, and again, some of these accounts are a little difficult to verify, of commanders dressing up, masquerading as historical figures in Shia mythology, and riding across the battlefield in dusk, and soldiers, you know, whispering among themselves, "Here's the Imam, he's guiding us into battle." So it's at the level of the practice of individual soldiers. It's also at the level of decision making. So that Ayatollah Khomeini refuses to retaliate for Iraqi use of chemical weapons because he argues, by his interpretation of Islamic law, one should not use weapons of mass destruction against other Muslims. So there's a real restraint there against using weapons of mass destruction, which is, you know, that's a pretty powerful finding. The fatality figures bear out the fact that religious practices, religious ideas, and religious identities had a very, very real effect. So that the units that were recruited based on a religious basis suffered fatalities that were double and triple those of other units. They essentially became suicide units. This is in fact the very, very old origin of what later on becomes suicide bombing, is this notion of, you know, essentially a soldier running into the battlefield in order to detonate a minefield, or sacrifice themselves in waves after waves after waves of human suicidal attacks. So there's an extreme case. It's an easy case. Mahsa Ruhi, who contributed this chapter, who did wonderful archival work and even did some contemporary interviews in Iran with people in the know, tells some amazing tales about how in a case where a country is really led by a theocratic regime that holds a pretty extreme version of religion, yes, then of course it really, really affects operations. But it also affects operations in a much more subtle case, like the Indian case, that's the second case study in that part of the book, where we already talked about sort of the makeup of units. It affects patterns of desertion and of mutiny. For example, in 1984, when there's an Indian attack on a Sikh sacred site, right, it's the Sikh soldiers that desert, but they do this in some units and not others, and the difference is interesting. And in general, the Indian government has been very, very careful not to privilege any one particular religion. So there's this wonderful photo in the book of an induction ceremony into the Indian military, and it looks a little like an Irish bar joke. There's one of each, right? There's a priest, and there's an imam, and so on and so forth down the line. You can see, you know, each one wearing his own religious garb. They're all present there. It's a very inclusive attitude towards religion, and the Indian military has learned over the years how to use its army, particularly when the religious issue is sensitive. So when the opponent might be of a particular religion, or when a particular sacred site is threatened, they've learned to take that into account in military operations.
That is really interesting, because India is one of these countries that has a number of different faith traditions, and yeah, some of them are very volatile. And you have to figure, well, do we separate them out? We have the Hindus in this unit, the Muslims in this unit, the Sikhs in this unit, and we'll put the Christians over here. But it turns out that might be leading to more mutinies than if you mixed everybody in there and said, hey, we're all on equal playing ground.
Right. Or if you go by region and you're, so on the, look, religion is a double-edged sword here. There's certainly some advantage to putting all Sikhs together in the same unit. You'd imagine that these units maybe would be more cohesive, would have an easier time sort of coordinating, would have a common language, would create these strong social bonds. And we know that that is why soldiers fight, right? It's these strong social bonds among soldiers. Soldiers do not die for their country. Soldiers do not die for the cause. Soldiers die for one another. So on the one hand, religion can forge these ties. On the other hand, yes, now when you've got an uprising or a desertion, you might lose an entire unit. And so what India has done in part is to emphasize regionality and ethnicity and get soldiers together, regardless of their religion, from the same area, and then very, very carefully engineer the numbers and think very hard about who should command the unit. Right? You want to make sure that you don't have the entire command structure be Muslim or the entire command structure be Hindu. So they've gone about it in a very smart way.
Well, these are some of the issues that you're going to be bringing up in your new book, and you have much, much more to say on that. And what we are going to do is pause our conversation here and then pick it up again in the spring when the book comes out, because you are filled with so many interesting insights here. But I do want to finish off with one question. In terms of this project, and I always love to ask this question of scholars, you had a chance to mull around with this for several years and talk to a lot of different people. Is there anything interesting or surprising that you learned that you didn't know about before, or that just seemed not so obvious but then became obvious and you had one of those aha moments? Anything like that?
Yeah, so lots of it. I mean, you know, I would have never imagined. I the Japanese case, for example, or the Canadian case, these were just shots in the dark. I had no idea that the British military still continues, you know, some of these very arcane religious practices that, you know, that, for example, every unit, every pretty small unit in the British Armed Forces has its own collection of prayers written for that particular unit, that unit prays together. You know, that's pretty surprising. But there's an overarching finding that caught me off guard, that I think is quite curious, and that is that in every military that I've looked at around the world, all these questions about how to accommodate religion, how to fulfill constitutional obligations, how to correct for demographic issues, how to correct for issues of command and promotion, in all militaries in the world I've looked at, these issues are constantly in flux. That was the surprise. I thought that there would have been at least one military that would have figured out what the winning formula was and would have stuck with that formula. And instead what you're seeing is changes in society, changes in the law, and changes in religious practices slip over and infiltrate the military and lead to changes in the military. Society then observes this, responds, sometimes approvingly, sometimes with outrage, until the next round. And so the U.S. military is constantly fiddling with the role that it assigns chaplains, which symbols are and aren't permitted, how you regulate religious speech, how you use religious symbols. These things are constantly, constantly changing. And they never reach sort of equilibrium point. And the Turkish case, which we haven't talked a lot about, is an example in point. As Turkey undergoes religious turmoil, the military, which for a while was very stable in its secular point of view, right? Religion was just sort of officially banished from the Turkish military, although not in practice. But as Turkey now undergoes this religious turmoil, the military has to change. And as the military changes, its ability to prop up, protect the regime, or oppose the regime changes, and so the country changes in response to the military. And so there's this constant back and forth, which means that religion and the military, in my mind, remains a constantly interesting, fascinating subject that never stops changing.
And that is what makes it so cool for all of us scholars to study this kind of stuff, and
yeah.
You are plunging into that wholeheartedly, and we look forward to your next book that comes out in spring, and we'll definitely have you back on the show then. Ron, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. It's a pleasure, as always.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion.
To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.